I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Phil Craig.
And I'm Andrew Loney.
And together we aim to bring you the most scandalous stories and some of the most scandalous people in history. So thanks for joining us here on the Scandalmongers podcast.
Hello, Andrew.
Hello, you're jet setting again.
I am. I'm in Madeira. Do you want to see?
Yeah, oh, you are.
Yeah.
Oh, lovely. Gosh.
View. On the balcony.
Is this early morning then?
It's the same time as you.
Oh, same time as me. Oh, right.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm just trying to balance this on a pile of books. Also, it's our birthday.
Yes, yes. Yes, they'll be celebrating in the Loney household today.
So we're 1 year old, and isn't it your actual birthday as well?
It is. It is indeed.
49 again?
Yes, yes, yes. I've been that for about 20 years now.
Well, talking of 40-something, I think this is our 41st programme in a year. And I think when we first discussed this, we thought we might do about 25.
Exactly. Yes, and we didn't expect to get the interest that we did. I mean, it's brilliant the way it's taken off in the last few episodes, really.
No, we're getting a lot of attention. And it's all very good because we're just in it for the attention, aren't we, really? Let's be honest.
Are we getting some good comments? Oh, well, we've been criticised for not knowing the Bowes line lineage in I Saw and Won.
Yes, well, we don't always get praise. I think we should be fair. Now, which was that one? Etch-A-Sketch has joined us, enjoying your channel very much and really liked the John Le Carré interview. If there's a funny hissing sound, that's not me. It's the water sprinklers next door to me. Rosemary Benjamin. Is the person you mentioned. She was going to subscribe. Yes. And if you're still with us, Rosemary, we're really sorry. But she thought that we got something wrong about the Bowes Lyon family.
Or was it Lady Colin Campbell?
It was Lady Colin Campbell, who is, let's face it, a rather divisive figure. A lot of people love her and love the show. Crazy Cunnock. I saw Lady C's name on the thumbnail and I clicked immediately. We'll now check out all your old shows. Honesta, 1828. Lots of other people said that they're really enjoying it with her on. Please bring Lady C back, said Simca 33.
Sorry, and I think we might. We want to talk about, we haven't really talked about Kate and William much. And there's been a certain amount of controversy about William overshadowing his father with his 75th birthday and the King's speech. So I think that may be an opportunity for her, or indeed to bring Valentine back or a new royal writer. But we've got Richard Kay this week, which is a bit of a coup.
That's really exciting. I mean, Richard, for those who don't know, he was probably the best connected royal writer, certainly during the Diana's time.
I think now, hugely respected and liked. He's ran a gossip column and still people liked him, but he's very well informed and I think has very good insights. I mean, he pulls it together. So I'm really looking forward to hearing what he has to say.
It was very helpful to me when I did my Diana work 20 odd years ago, and And I think there are things he knows about Diana that he's never written about and never will.
Yes. Yes, he's very modest.
They became genuinely close friends, and she would ring him, and she would ring him a lot during the final years of her life. They were on the phone many times a day, and he's always respected a lot of those confidences, which makes him, you know, all the more interesting a writer, actually.
Yes, no, and I mean, he's incredibly well-informed, as you know, when I'm doing my Andrew book. I mean, he is probably, the Mail have done very good coverage of Andrew and Fergie, and he has been the chief role person there.
It's funny, isn't it, how discretion can sometimes be a really useful part of a biographer's or a writer's armoury. You know, thinking of Randy Tarabarelli, who told us that, you know, he often just cuts stuff out if he thinks it's too hurtful. And, you know, it isn't going to benefit anybody to air this kind of dirty laundry.
Yes. No, I think it's a long game, and you need to build relationships. And I've certainly found that I've been able to go back to people for subsequent books, and they've been helpful because I didn't say, for example, people who were romantically involved with some of my characters, and I didn't really make that very clear. But I agree. I mean, of course, this is the big dilemma. I mean, the famous Graham Greene quote about every writer needs a shaft of ice in their heart. But in some ways, you know, the good guys sometimes do win.
No, that's it. That's it. And I think Richard Kay is one of those good guys.
Yeah.
Before we go to Richard, should we talk about what's coming up next? We're not entirely royal obsessed, as we keep saying. We've got an interesting show next week on perhaps the biggest scandal ever to affect the BBC, that of Jimmy Savile.
Yep, a paedophile with, again, close connections with the royal family. There's been a recent drama about it. And I think we're going to be talking to probably the expert on him. I mean, who's written a book on him.
Fingers crossed. Emails are flying around. But we've got a lot of interesting things bubbling. And as you say, I know it's our first birthday. I haven't got the full figures, but we're getting on towards 200,000 downloads.
Great. Which,
if you told us that a year ago, I think we'd have said, wow.
So, we were pleased when we got to 500 on an episode.
We were. And we were pleased to get 1,000 subscribers, and now we're pushing on towards 2.5. So, you know, a heartfelt thank you from me, from Andrew, from all the people of Madeira, in fact.
Well, I mean, it's very nice that people want to listen to us and our guests, and we're beginning a sort of relationship with them. I mean, we've had Julie on, and we hope to have other subscribers appearing and telling us things, because often they know much more than we do about certain subjects.
That's right. That's right. We're going to do that. And we've got a little kind of club of people who've been on the show a couple of times that, you know, we'll get them all back. Laura Thompson, Valentine Lowe, hopefully Colin Campbell. So that's all good. Thank you so much, everybody who's found us and stayed with us this year. Here's to a equally successful year too.
Yep. And Phil will go and celebrate Madeira, and I will begin the party celebrations in London.
Oh, happy birthday, Andrew.
Thank you.
Here's Richard coming up. Bye.
Bye.
Well, I've just pressed the magic record button. So welcome. Okay. Welcome to our little world.
Thank you. Thank you.
Corner of the internet.
And we've got a little sort of corner here of doing talks on royals. And I mean, you are now the doyen of royal reporters. And
it's one way of describing me, elderly.
You've been around the block.
Yeah, slightly. Yeah.
But no, you're brilliant. And I mean, I just know from doing my book research on Prince Andrew, how you just got wonderful stuff, way ahead of anyone else. And I think Phil's very keen to talk to you about Princess Diana and where things stand there, well, and the whole sort of historiography.
It's intriguing, isn't it? I mean, here we are, Phil, 26 years on, 27 years on this year, and we're still talking about Diana dominating this next series of The Crown. They really are stretching it out a bit, aren't they? I mean, I think they're devoting 3 or 4 episodes to a 6-week period, whereas in previous series, they've done about 10 years in 4 episodes.
She's going to even appear as a ghost, isn't she?
Oh, yeah, as a ghost this time. Yeah.
Really? Do you feel it's just too much then?
Oh, I don't know about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, I mean, I'm in no position to criticize The Crown. I mean, The Mail has obviously written lots about Diana over the last quarter of a century plus, because people are still interested in her. I mean, that's my point, really, that there's still an astonishing amount of interest in her.
And well, do you think there's a consensus now?
Sorry.
Or do you think there's still a big debate about a whole, all various parts of her life, from her death through to how she was treated and how she behaved?
Well, I think there is still a debate, if you like, about that. And that, of course, has been crystallized really by the Crown's interpretation of the events of those last years of her life in particular. And I think, yes, and again, recently when Mohammed Al-Fayed passed away, it brought back the memories of his claims about conspiracy and how she died. Was she killed? So I don't think those things are ever really going to go away. Whether there's been a proper reassessment of Diana, I suspect not, largely because her ex-husband is now the king. And, there's a feeling I feel it within the media generally to sort of give Charles a reasonable start and see whether he makes a fist of being a monarch.
Well, when we worked together, Richard, this was 21 years ago.
Yeah.
The question of Diana's treatment at the hands of the royals, the briefings against her, some of the things that were said about her mental state and how certain things like this supposed diagnosis of borderline personality disorder was disseminated. We talked about this a lot.
Yes.
And maybe it's time for us no longer to talk about these things and just move on. But do you think there's anything from that era that is still an unexploded bomb, if you like, under Charles? Or is he in clear water now?
I don't know whether there's an unexploded bomb waiting to detonate. I mean, my experience of writing and reporting on the royals is that we only ever scratch the surface. Andrew, you must be finding that. We are very much peering in. I was lucky that for a few years I got a chance to sort of step beyond the glass windows briefly and sort of get inside. But there are, I'm certain, an awful lot of secrets that could emerge. The king dispensed with someone who'd been with him for nigh on 45 years last year. I think we both know who we're talking about here, Michael Fawcett. What a story that man would have to tell if he ever got round to telling it. Look, I'm sure there are many interesting things that have yet to come out, whether they would impinge on Charles and whether they were and his ability as monarch, I don't know. But I'm always reminded of what Diana said in the now notorious Bashir interview, that she always thought that he wasn't actually up to the job of being king. Now, he's only been in the role for a year. It is early days, and we'll have to wait and see how that pans out.
Well, one of the things that has emerged in the last 2 years is Harry talking openly about the atmosphere of that time, and maybe also the years after Diana's death when they were trying to make Camilla more acceptable, and he is suggesting that other members of the family were thrown under the bus as a consequence of that, and that she herself was partly responsible for hanging people out to dry to create space for herself. So I don't know whether that's something that is anything really behind.
Well, I think there was. I mean, Phil, you were very much reporting on all that era, as was I, and they were the people, the handlers at that time, were desperately trying to get a reset with the public for the then Prince of Wales and Charles. And part of it was to overcome this huge, apparent, I thought, unscalable obstacle in the shape of Camilla, that he would never be able to make her his wife. But of course, he carried on and he made her such an essential part of his life that I think the Queen just wearied of the whole topic. And she also came to the view that, with her own experience of 60 or 70 years on the throne, it was better to have someone at your side, probably than doing it alone. Plus there was the constitutional issue. What would happen if the Queen died and Charles was still betwixt and between, with a mistress and not a wife? And so I think there was a lot of tidying up of these loose ends. I think they were very nervous. Back in 2005 about what public reaction would be. It was only, eight years after Diana's death. Her memory was still quite strong. But they sort of pulled it all together. But yes, going on to your point about briefings, Harry's point, of course, was that he and William were sort of sacrificed, as he put it, on Camilla's PR altar, Well, possibly. I mean, the fact is William and Harry were encouraged, not exactly to forget about their mother, but to concentrate on the future, on their father. What their mother had done with her, with the media was something that was frowned on within the palace. They were encouraged not to do that. And the consequence, from my point, I found rather sad was that, for the first 10 years at least, and really for up until 2017, neither William nor Harry engaged with their mother's memory, and they knew very little about her, what drove her, and what all her problems were at the time of her death.
That's so interesting. I mean, something clearly happened that rankled with Harry, and God knows, maybe he's also paranoid at this point. But when everything went wrong with Meghan, he goes back to that, doesn't he? Because he says they won't defend her. They won't sort of do anything that might offend the powers that be, and they will trade stories with journalists. I don't personally believe they do any actual trading. This idea that there is a powerful figure in the palace who can decide who gets supported, who gets defended, it's clearly something Harry believes. Do you think there's anything in that at all?
No, I don't. I mean, I think there's a system, and you have to conform to the system, and William and Kate clearly have, and perhaps Harry and Meghan were too much of what we call them, disruptors, if you like. They wanted to do things differently. But the fact is that when she arrived on the scene, and in those first rather uplifting months when we were all contemplating what this girl with her heritage and background could bring to the British royal family, there was an enormous amount of support for her. But, you know, it's difficult to know what went wrong. I think Harry has exaggerated some of the slights which he feels were shown towards his wife, and as a consequence, they've since doubled down on them all. But no, I don't think there was one fixer who was sort of controlling, pulling the strings, if you like. What I would say, Phil, though, is going back in time to that period between 97 and 2002, 2003, when you were writing your book, if they weren't exactly trades going on for other stories, then certainly there was a method in what the palace were doing in promoting Charles by, if you like, briefing against some of his siblings, because if one was down, then the other would be up, and I can see how that worked.
Do you remember the famous St. Andrews debacle?
I do.
When Edward's company was accused of harassing William, and it was actually based on very, very little, but the press went nuclear on it.
Yeah, I mean, the reason the press went nuclear on it was because we'd all signed up to this fairly all-encompassing restrictive deal, all obviously on because of what happened to his mother, and we agreed that we would leave them alone for the duration of their full-time education. That, of course, kept expanding and expanding, as you know, went on to include his army years and even later. But nevertheless, it was a deal which we agreed to. And so there was a great deal of lip smacking pleasure when the when the organization that should breach this deal turned out to be his own uncle. Yeah.
Interesting.
Do you think those sort of arrangements are now very difficult? Because, I mean, the paparazzi, the foreign papers, it's very hard to come to those sort of arrangements now.
Well, the paparazzi and the foreign papers were always there, Andrew. But the paparazzi depend on a market which has to be created in the UK first, because the European and American market really react to what we're saying and what's being said here. No, I think the real problem they've got now is the technology is so much more advanced. Is of course the smartphone, the Twitter sphere. They have very little control. I mean, the classic example, of course, is what happened to that very distinguished former lady in waiting to the late Queen, Lady Susan Hussey, almost a year ago, next month, I think it was, when she made these what were seen to be or alleged to be racist remarks to a a woman of color at a Buckingham Palace reception, and the whole thing exploded, and the palace were very much caught on the hop and were forced to really to dance to the tune of social media. And that for me was a sign of how things have shifted. I mean, the newspapers don't have the circulations they once had, but they've obviously got websites which are hugely popular. But largely, it seems now that the palace are more concerned about the influence of Twitter and Instagram.
So, I mean, this idea that the mystique of the monarchy, I mean, that's, I mean, they've got to engage. I mean, they've got to, with the media. There's no way they can just shut the doors and not cooperate.
No, I don't think they can shut the doors and not cooperate. I mean, mystique of the monarchy, yes, okay, fine. But monarchy depends on its visibility too. You know, if we know nothing about them and they become obscure, then they will wither and become irrelevant. So no, but it's always been this sort of balancing act of how much to give of themselves. Many would say that Diana gave too much. Some would say that the Queen didn't give enough. You know, and William, I think, is trying to sort of take us forward into the 21st century in a way that his father is probably incapable of doing, largely because of his age and upbringing.
And what is William doing then? I mean, what do you think the strategy is?
Well, I mean, it is easy to see that he's much more in tune with younger views, but that, again, understandable. He's only 41. Is he the wokest member of the royal family? Well, probably people would say that Harry trumps him on that score, but he is, I think he's conscious of the fact that he's the inheritor to a very old-fashioned, rather hidebound institution, and that there is concern, I think, among palace advisors about where the long-term popularity and relevance of the monarchy is going. I mean, the most recent polls have been very interesting when you drill down into who likes them and who doesn't, and what the age brackets are and their social brackets. And I think William is very aware that among young people, there isn't a connection with the monarchy that there is among those over 65. So I think he knows that if it's to survive for him and his son, George, then he's going to have to take account of all that. I think Charles is, it's easy to describe him as a caretaker monarch. He'd hate anyone saying that, but the fact is he isn't going to be monarch for long. What is his role? I think his role is to ensure that there's a monarchy to hand over to William at some time in the future. He might have 10 years. It's unlikely he'll have a silver jubilee. But all these things must be running around in the backs of the minds of those people at the palace who we like to think are pulling the strings, Phil.
Interesting. I mean, it is obvious what Harry and it's not obvious. It's quite, as you laid out, William and Kate have got an agenda which they're pursuing, and I think in Kate doing rather well, especially with her, but and the children. If you look at the supermarket tabloids, people are obsessed with those kids, and maybe rightly so. But what the really big thing they could do, of course, is to try and bring Harry and Meghan back.
Yeah.
Now their strategy, who knows? Now they've had their book. They've had their series. Could you see a reconciliation, and could you see William triggering that reconciliation?
I think it's going to be very hard for William to trigger a reconciliation because of what Harry said, not just about him, but particularly about Kate. William is very much a Spencer. And one of the things I learned about the Spencers over the years is they're not hugely forgiving. You know, if you transgress, they're not over likely to welcome you back into the fold. However, William is pragmatic. He knows that the public, although they quite like the narrative of the black sheep of the family, they'd much rather have the family reunited and to have something of Harry and Meghan contributing to royal life here. They're both stubborn, of course, in many ways. I think the king is much more likely to be the one to extend the olive branch. but I think it's going to be really difficult for what happens long term. There's going to have to be some apologies offered and accepted. And at the moment, I see no sign on either side of an apology being forthcoming.
It's so interesting. Look at the problem they're having in Africa, though. These tours to African states are becoming politically very difficult now. Harry and Meghan, if they were to, even if whether they lived in California or not, if they were to be the people representing the royal family in many other parts of the world than Britain, I suspect that would make a big difference. But
I think you're
probably too strategic.
I think you're onto something now. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why the late Queen suggested that Harry and Meghan should concentrate on the Commonwealth, because, you know, let's not be too cynical about it. Meghan had a reach to those parts of the Commonwealth, which no white prince or princess can possibly reach. I think it's a terrible shame, a crying shame, really, that because of what happened, they haven't been able to utilize what would have been a brilliant secret weapon for the monarchy.
Yeah, and Harry, too, he had a very long and deep affection and lots of deep contacts with Africa. It was one of the stupidest things about that breakup, I think, for the long-term future.
But things are shifting because of this. You know, there are tectonics plates shifting here. You know, a lot of the Commonwealth countries and the realms are talking about breaking with Britain. The whole issue of reparations over slavery and empire is really tricky for the royal family. The king had to touch on it on his visit to Kenya last week. No apology, but an acknowledgement.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
That things had been done in the past which shouldn't have been done. And we all remember what happened when William and Kate went to the Caribbean at the beginning of 2022, and they had a rather disastrous trip to Jamaica and elsewhere, where that whole issue of the past came back to bite them.
I mean, the other lurking problem is Andrew. I mean, how is that likely to play out?
Wow, that's a real big problem. Andrew, I don't see how Prince Andrew can ever take any kind of meaningful role within the royal family again. And now I think we've actually reached a stage where that's sort of accepted on both sides. Whether Andrew accepts it or not, I simply don't know. But then this whole issue of his property keeps coming up. Why should a man who has no effective public role live in this vast home on the King's estate at Windsor? Yes, his mother gave it to him, but the whole thing about monarchy and monarchies is that when the reign changes, everything changes. And really, Charles would be quite within his rights to remove Andrew from Royal Lodge. and place him possibly in Prince Harry's old home or any other countless smaller properties they've got. I think one of the issues Charles does have in this idea of a slimmed down monarchy is that he hasn't slimmed down the property portfolio, and the public at a time of a recession and cost of living crisis, they cast envious glances at what's going on at the royal family, and they think it's unfair. And I think Charles is really stuck on this. You know, you ask yourself, what has he actually done in the 14 months or so since he's been king? Well, he's steadied the ship, no doubt about it. But he hasn't been hugely visible. He's done a number of foreign trips at the request of the government. Curious that the first two he did were to Europe, France, and then Germany, or Germany, then France. And now he's been to Kenya because of the sort of that emotional pull which links his mother to Kenya, because that was where she became queen in 1952. So it is interesting, but where is the strategic paper on his plan that he was talking about, Phil, back in 1999, 2000, about a slimmed down monarchy, closing up Kensington Palace? I remember that, one of the headlines from that period. Well, nothing's happened on that score yet. And I think people want to see some kind of action. I mean, it has been slimmed down, as you rightly point out, Andrew, because Prince Andrew is no longer a member of the working royals, and the cousins, who are always referred to as the cousins, you know, the Dukes of Gloucester and Kent, are getting on, and they can't go on forever. What's going to happen when they stand down?
Well, I mean, I know Prince Andrew is keen that his daughters have a role. Do you think that's going to happen? Because they don't have enough people to do everything.
I think that's a real problem. I know Andrew is very keen. He fought long and hard, for example, to try and maintain their Scotland Yard protection. He lost that battle. Andrew himself has had to pay for private security for his daughters. And they have pretty much moved on, I think, from royal life. I mean, they do a bit of charity work. They support their mother, and occasionally they were supporting him, and they do a couple of things in their own regard. But I don't think the king wants his nieces to have major roles within the royal family going forward. I think we know who he's got in mind. He very much wants his sister to have a central role. He's come around to the Duke and Duchess of Edinburgh, the Wessexes, as were Prince Edward and Sophie. They're seen as essential to the project, but I don't think there's any room for Beatrice and Eugenie.
And what about Lady Louise? I mean, the Wessex's daughter. I mean, because she seems to be very popular. Would you think that whole generation will be sort of kept out?
I think it will. I mean, I think the fact that Edward and Sophie decided that their son and daughter were going to be raised privately, were going to not have high profile, they're not HRHs, which they could have been. I think that suggests to me that they're going to go down the same route as Princess Anne's children, Peter and Zara, who've made careers for themselves outside the royal magic circle.
And I mean, you're talking about planning for the future. I mean, was the Christopher Guite one of the guiding sort of figures in that? And with him no longer so active, there is a problem there.
Yeah, I mean, Christopher Guite was the late Queen's private secretary, but he fell out with the then Prince of Wales over his plans to try and, as the Queen aged, Guite wanted to bring Charles much more into the immediate circle around his mother. When Prince Philip died, Charles became sort of the de facto head of the family. And it sort of backfired because Charles felt that Guite was trying to corral him, prevent him from doing the kind of things that he liked to do as Prince of Wales. Of course, Guite realized that those things were not going to be on the agenda once Charles became king. I mean, he's the former outspoken prince has had to very much toe a party line now. A sort of the role of the monarch is very different from the role of the heir to the throne.
And one of the other questions is, I mean, how rich is Prince Andrew? Did he inherit money from his grandmother or his mother?
Well, I think we're certain he would have inherited money from Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother. And I don't know what money he got from the Queen. I mean, it would have all been arranged long before she died, and she will have known that he would have been needed to be financially secure. I mean, the Queen was extremely close to Andrew. She thought he was very foolish at times, but there was a particular soft spot between the Queen and her second son. And I imagine she has provided for him. Whether that's quite enough. I mean, the one thing I learned over the years, and as I'm sure you're discovering, is that Andrew burns through money. He likes the good things in life. He's still supporting, or was still supporting, his ex-wife, although the suggestion is that she may now be financially supporting him. I'd find that quite hard to believe, because I don't think she's making anything like the money that she used to make all those years ago. But yes, you know, if he isn't supported by money left to him by Queen Elizabeth, then King Charles is the only place he can go for finance. And that might be tricky for him, because Charles would then have the whip hand, and he would then be able to impose his will on Andrew, make him give up Royal Lodge, if that's the wish. I mean, the thought is that Charles wants to give Royal Lodge to William and Kate, but William and Kate are awash with homes. And I think it would be a bad look for the king and for the monarchy if right now Andrew was evicted, say, and William and Kate and their family moved into Royal Lodge, even if it did make some kind of logical sense, because he has all these other homes, William, here, I'm talking about here.
And so do you think Andrew is making money just quietly, let's say in the Middle East or in Asia, through contacts he may have made as trade envoy?
Excuse me. Well, I don't think he is anymore, Andrew. I mean, I think he did, and I think he made a lot of money. I mean, I think having that ambassadorship opened so many doors and opportunities to him personally.
Yeah.
It's been almost impossible to find out just how much money Andrew made all that through that period, but it would be naive to think that he didn't exploit some of those contacts he made and make some money for himself.
I feel sure our Andrew will be digging away into that for
it's best-selling book. That interests me.
We're jumping around a little. Andrew's interested in Andrew. I'm interested in Harry and Meghan. And one more question on them, because it's so great to have access to your mind.
Yes, they do.
I mean, if there's not going to be a reconciliation, and I suspect there isn't in the short term, what do you see of Harry and Meghan's future as semi-detached royals in California?
It's really hard to see how things are going to pan out for Harry and Meghan, because they've chose to settle in the one part of the world where everything is about novelty. And once you lose your novelty, you become very stale and secondhand news. I mean, it's apparent that the attitude of Americans towards them has changed in the last year. They were their royal family members when they moved to California, and there was a huge amount of support for them. But the tawdriness of Harry's book, the uncomfortable feeling that they generated with their Netflix show, which was so partial and one-sided, you know, even the most one-eyed supporters in the States began to question what exactly they were doing and saying. But I think the main problem they've got is one of novelty. I mean, how are they going to go forward? What are they going to do to make themselves relevant, to make themselves interested? And Meghan has been extremely quiet this year, really below the radar. What's going on? You know, you've read that she's working on her memoir. Then someone else says she's not working on a memoir. She's going to have a reset. No, she's not having a reset. I mean, she's got agents. Of course she has. And she must be trying to work out what she's going to do. I don't think she's going to go back into acting. But the lifestyle they lead in California is immensely expensive. They have wraparound 24-hour-a-day security. They have to have it. There are too many lunatics around. But this all costs a lot of money. I've seen a conservative estimate for their security costs is somewhere in the region of $10 million. That's a lot of money. And living in California is not cheap either, all these property taxes. So I don't know what their immediate plans are. They are tentatively out and about a bit more this autumn than they have been in the summer months. They're probably trying to work out what the public reaction is, see how it goes. But
and we've also got this Ovid Scobie book. I mean, presumably that's their man on earth who's going to be doing the pushing forward some sort of agenda.
Yes, I think he is. Although he seems to have moved so far in the opposite direction. I mean, he's almost as though he's now, attacking the other members of the royal family, in a way that we were talking earlier on, to try and sort of bolster support for Harry. Is Scobie still their sort of agent? I'm not entirely sure. It'll be fascinating to see his book when it comes out. How much of that is the, reflects the views, and positions of the Sussexes remains to be seen.
Gosh. And the other big debate is about official lives for the Queen and Prince Philip. I mean, do you think a decision will be made on that soon? And will they go for a multi-volume, for example, series of books on the Queen's reign?
I think there will be huge pressure for a very serious historian to be given the gig of writing the Queen's life. Not sure about the Duke of Edinburgh's, Prince Philip's. It usually takes quite a few years. I mean, I think Shawcross, who wrote Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother's book, wasn't given the position until about 5 or 6 years, or invited to about 5 or 6 years after her death. I mean, the Queen is a huge task. It could easily be a 10-year job because all the papers that would have to be gone through. I don't know who's on his list. I've seen the same speculation as you have about who might be up for it. And yes, I suspect they will want that there will be friends of Prince Philip's who would want to see some kind of official life of him too. I mean, Charles has a huge influence in all this. I mean, ultimately, they will be his choices. He will choose the biographers or historians, and no one else.
Right. Interesting. I mean, you suspect that they may even just leave Prince Philip. I mean, there are books, for example, Giles Brandreth, who clearly was very close to the Queen and Prince Philip. Will that just not be enough?
Well, I think it'd be a tragedy if all we get on Prince Philip's life is the view of Giles Brandreth, who likes to position himself very much centre stage. I think there are some. I'm sure there would be a proper volume to be done on him, but I don't know. He may have left instructions to have nothing. He may have said, no, "I don't want an official biography." I mean, he. Unlike the Queen, he sorted out his own papers before his death. And one of the reasons why he retired in 2017 was to devote what years he had left to do some filing. I mean, I think a lot of the filing saw a lot of correspondence destroyed. But obviously, a fair amount will have gone into the archive too. But he was a man without great sentiment. And he saw his role as very much as we know, as a support act to the monarch. It wouldn't surprise me at all if Philip has given instructions that he doesn't want an authorized biography. Question is whether his son would observe that or not.
Interesting. Gosh, so many things gone.
I was just thinking, when did you start, Richard? You must be 40 years in this game, man.
It's coming, getting close, Phil. I think I started in 1986. Yeah. I mean, I did report on the Charles and Diana's wedding because my name's still on the splash from the Mail back in 1981, but I moved on to do other things. I went over to Ireland, was the Irish correspondent for 3 years and then came back in the mid 80s and took up the Royals in, I think it was the year of, the Fergie and Andrew's wedding.
Gosh. And is it, I mean, are there other things you would have liked to have done, or are you very happy to have this long run?
It's, you know, I work on the Mail, Andrew. It's a popular newspaper, and writing about the Royals was always, even back in the 80s, well, especially back in the 80s, was always very much sort of front of the book stuff, as we say. It was important to the commercial success of the paper. So it was nice to be involved in that. Yeah. I mean, look, if you're asking me, when I became a journalist, did I think of in terms of writing pieces about members of the royal family that was going to be my career path? I'd have said, good God, no. I mean, we all think we're going to be Woodward and Bernstein when we start. But, you know, things happen, and I'm sure they happen for a reason. I took it up having had three quite different years in Ulster. And fancied something completely different, and I stuck with it. I mean, various things worked out for me. Obviously, getting to know Diana was a huge influence, and one of the reasons why I sort of stuck with it for so long.
And has that helped you build up contacts? I mean, you presumably know lots and lots of people, you know, who.
Well, I did, but you know. People come and go within the royal family. It's very much like civil service. They tend to retire quite early. The rest of us have to carry on laboring away at the coalface, as all three of us know.
Maybe you'll get the biography, the 10-year biography job, Richard.
I don't think so. I'm not going to be on any biography lists at the palace. No.
Well, it's so lovely to talk to you, and thank you for, you know, opening up your memories and your mind and your insight. Because I think it's fair to say that of all the people, that when you do talk to people in the palaces, and I did when I did my work, Richard's name always came up as the one person that they trusted amongst the journalists.
Well, that's very kind to hear and good to hear. I mean, I don't know how things have panned out since then. Things are obviously much more different. I mean, I've been very interested. I have a back seat now. I don't just do the Royals. I do other things, but I look at the way the Royals are reported, and it seems to me that the royal family have got an iron grip on the reporting that comes out now. And the stories that used to break in the 80s and particularly in the 90s simply don't happen anymore. And I find that quite curious. About how my successors, not on the Mail, but generally elsewhere in Fleet Street and beyond, there's a lot more, how should I put it, gush than there once was. Maybe we're responding to events and the way that what people want to read about now. But I think it's also got a lot to do with the control. I mean, we touched on social media earlier. One point I would make is I've been very interested watching how William and Kate, handle their public relations and, you know, Kate taking photographs of her children. She's a confident and competent photographer. But that's a really interesting development, and it's sort of closed off a once lucrative market. It's quite a canny move on their part, and also the way they use social media to promote what they're doing. I mean, I'm not saying the press has had its day. It hasn't, because they still do engage with the mainstream press, and it's the mainstream press that go on these very expensive royal tours, and they need them because they are so expensive, and bloggers and so forth can't afford to take flights to Kenya and stay in expensive hotels. So, but things have changed. There's no doubt about it. I would say the coverage is much more positive in a more complimentary way than it once was.
Can you imagine Diana on Twitter? It would have been 24/7, wouldn't it?
24/7. Terrifying. Yeah.
Well, look, so thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Noel.
Please come back one day.
Well, it's lovely talking to you both. And good luck, Andrew, with Andrew.
Well, thank you.
And all everything else. I'm sure we'll want to serialize it when the day comes.
Oh, I'll be in touch.
And Phil, are you in touch with Patrick Jeffson?
I am very much in touch with Patrick. He was actually on the podcast not long ago.
Good.
And he's still a great friend. And yeah. I'm actually working on a book on the Second World War, which is...
Okay.
No gush. No gush.
Oh, good. Good to hear it.
Great. See you later.
Lovely to see you.
Thanks a lot. Okay. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Scandalmongers podcast. This has been a Podcast World production. You can get in contact with our show by emailing team@podcastworld.org, placing Scandalmongers in the heading, or via our social media links within the show's bio.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.